Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The recall election of a county supervisor in the North State is setting off political tremors throughout California. County Supervisor Leonard Modi, a conservative and former Redding police chief who has been in office since 2009, is poised to be recalled after an apparent successful effort, according to current election returns. The results aren't final yet, but essentially there aren't enough outstanding votes to change the outcome. The remaining count will determine who will be the successor. Shasta County is among the most conservative in the state. Former President Donald Trump received twice as many votes than President Biden. But a recall ousting a mainstream Republican highlights a party dissonance growing in communities across California. And the political atmosphere in Shasta County has been fraught with tension and, at its most extreme, threats of safety for those working to ensure a fair election. Kathy Darling Allen is the Shasta County Clerk and Registrar of Voters and has led elections in the county for nearly 20 years, overseeing more than two dozen elections. Registrar Allen joins us now. Welcome to Inside, and thank you for making the time.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, you're familiar with the round-the-clock hustle that elections can bring with your experience, but this recall has taken on kind of like a life in and of itself. Before we dive into the returns and what the process is going to be, I just want to check in. How are you and your staff doing?
We're doing okay. This week has been much better. Last week was pretty high pressure, pretty uncomfortable at times.
Yeah. Where do you stand right now with the election results? Although the results aren't final, there's still a process that's going to take place through next week and even possibly the week after.
Correct. So later today, we're going to tabulate the last kind of larger group of ballots that we have, as you said. That will determine who the winner is for the successor candidate. We have just under 300 ballots to add into the count. So that won't touch the yes, no question at all. As you say, that's pretty much, I think, decided. But we don't ever call an election until we've counted every vote. So we will process those ballots today. Tomorrow, we have another deadline for voters who may have returned ballots without signing the envelope. So we have to wait for that to roll by. And then those folks who are able to make it here and or contact us and cure those problems, we'll be able to count those ballots on Monday morning. And then Monday morning we'll begin our final audit, which is a risk limiting audit. Because the margin is so tight between that first and second vote getter for the successor candidate, we are assuming we're going to end up into a full hand recount of all the ballots as part of that audit. Which frankly we welcome to hopefully ensure and communicate some integrity of these results to the community as a whole.
Yeah, you're talking about such a lengthy and in-depth process to ensure a fair election, and you became Registrar of Voters in 2004. You have been elected four times. What led you wanting to oversee Shasta County elections?
You know, I have never talked to anyone who works in elections who said, when I was a little girl, I wanted to be an election official.
Right.
That's not how people enter this field. You kind of fall into it. My mom was super politically active, and I grew up in Washington, D.C. I used to study in high school at the Library of Congress in the reading room. So I grew up with my hometown newspaper covering the White House, right, every day. So I've always had a strong interest in politics and when I came out here to California to go to school, I ended up getting married. And when I was working here, I went to work at the welfare department here locally, and a friend called me, and I kind of worked my way up there and said, hey, you know, the assistant county clerk is going to retire soon, and that might be a really good fit for you. And honestly, if she hadn't made that phone call, I probably wouldn't have applied for the job, and I wouldn't be sitting here now. But when I started in elections, the retiring at the time assistant county clerk, who's a lovely woman, said to me, this is never a boring job. And she was right. You know, the laws change every year, and it's such a wonderfully fulfilling and gratifying thing to know that every day I come to work and I'm supporting my community and helping the people in this county petition their government through their ballot. And truly, everyone I've ever met who works in this space has a really deep understanding of how important the work that we do every day is. We are not just walking in, so to speak. So it's really a wonderful career and a wonderful area to work in. And that has turned into a little bit of a different environment over the last 5 years. And so we're all kind of grappling with that and trying to figure out how to manage that.
Yeah, a different environment in a job that is never boring. This recall election has garnered national headlines. Has there ever been an election with this tone and this message in Shasta County before? I mean, you have enhanced security precautions at your elections office as a result.
We have not had this level of negative attention without a cause. That's what I think that's the thing that's most important to understand. It's not as if we made some very serious error that we had to correct and people are worried. This is not a result of any action I have taken or anyone in my office has taken. And so it's kind of like being accused of a crime that you didn't commit. So we're really struggling with how to get ourselves to a place with folks who have concerns and questions where they will believe in the integrity of the election. It's been a tough couple of weeks for sure.
You've described a lot of emotion in your community. How is this being directed at you and your staff, tasked with the election results?
So we haven't had any direct threats. I don't want to overstate the situation. No one's threatened the office. No one's threatened me directly. But we've had some many very aggressive phone calls and some very pointed comments on social media that have led us to want to tighten up security quite a bit, which we have. And the best thing that we can do is continue to do the work in the same way that we always have done it. That's been our strategy, is to try and emphasize for folks that this is the same schedule of results reporting that we always use in elections. When the election results were really tight on Tuesday night, we got a lot of pressure that next day. Well, why aren't you counting today? Because we don't count on Tuesdays, on Wednesdays. That's not what we do on Wednesday. We have a schedule for the election week. And we've tried to really adhere to those very same procedures that have served us well over the past, 37 elections that I've conducted in Shasta County.
Wow. So more than three dozen. And you touched upon the fact that the recall election is in the spotlight now, but this climate of skepticism goes back further than this Board of Supervisor seat in Shasta County. How do you navigate a time when your mission and your integrity has not changed, but the way some people view the process has, and they're loud about it?
Well, I mean, like I say, we just keep on keeping on, and we continue to do what we've always done, which is to invite people in to view the process. So we have a handful of folks who come and observe every single election, but we invite anyone who is interested in the election to come to our office and see what we're doing, get a tour, understand how it is we process ballots, all the security measures that we have in place, and that is sometimes really helpful. In the past, 10 years ago, that was a silver bullet. When folks got a chance to see how the mechanics of a ballot worked, what the path of travel was from a voter voting it, going to the post office, coming to our office, and all the different tracking mechanisms we have in place, that really helped a lot. But ever since the 2020 election, I can have a 20 or 30 minute conversation on the phone with the voter. And I have heard many times, unfortunately, at the end of those conversations, "Well, you sound really sincere, but I don't believe you." So my voice is never going to be louder than some of the folks who are spreading bad information on social media and other, national outlets. I'm a very insulated in some ways, right? I have a very limited scope of what I'm in charge of. And so all I can do is assure folks that that's not how we do it in Shasta County. Whatever you saw on the internet.
Yeah.
When my youngest child was 8 years old, she said to me, "You know, Mom, not everything on the internet is true." And I want to make a bumper sticker. I think this is that.
Given what is unfolding since the 2020 election and what's happening now, what would be helpful to you in managing or future elections? Because you're talking about all these checks and balances at the election office and opportunities for individuals, for citizens to see the process firsthand. And now that's starting to fall short in terms of trust. Is there anything that can be done? I guess what goes through your mind when you're looking about or thinking of solutions?
So it's really interesting. I have been asked this question several dozen times in the last couple of weeks. And while I am the county clerk and the registrar of voters, it is absolutely my job to answer that question, and I will. It is I always have to point out now, it's my new thing, is to point out that nobody's asking the people who are the ones that broke trust in elections. Those folks are not getting these questions asked of them. And so that's really tough. I think one of the things that would be great is if the people who do come and observe, you know, and many of them do already, they are our ambassadors into communities that have a lot of concern about the process. And so we rely on those folks to some degree to carry the message to people they know. And that word of mouth, our community, there's just under 200,000 people that live here in Shasta County, and it is really still a very small town in some ways. And so for us, word of mouth is really important.
And you are a part of that small town. I mean, it's a tight-knit community. Many live there for generations. I mean, I would imagine this must have trickled or is trickling into this beloved aspect of the place that you call home.
Absolutely. I think that's the thing I've tried to emphasize with some people, and it frequently falls on deaf ears. But, you know, I and the people who work here and poll workers who work the polls, we all live here and we go to grocery stores together. We all have kids in school here or grandkids in school here. We use all the same parks, you know, that kind of humanizing aspect. I know that when I'm speaking to someone who doesn't want to hear that I'm not going to make a dent in their assumptions about what we're doing in this office. So when I start, that's another strategy that I use, is to try and emphasize the fact that I live here too. I'm a taxpayer here and a voter here too, just like everyone who works in this office. And when I get pushback on that fact, I stop.
Yeah.
They're not interested in seeing me as an actual person as opposed to an internet cutout that they can poke holes in. You know, there's no point in having a conversation.
Right. You're not human. You're a projection, essentially.
Right. In their mind, yes.
Yes. Finally, given that you've been elected four times as registrar, are you running this for re-election this midterm? Because you would be up this time, correct?
I am. Yeah. Candidate filing opens on Monday, and I am running for office again.
Why stick with it?
I love what I do. And all this gray hair aside, I turned 53 a couple of months ago, so I'm not exactly in a rocking chair yet. Although this gray hair certainly makes me feel like I should be in a rocking chair at some point. This is an incredibly important function of our government. And it's an incredibly complex process. Most people who come and see us and understand how this works tell us, and I remember this very well when I came to work here, had no idea what was required to put an election on it. There are a lot of moving parts, and I want to be sure that that I can hand off this office at some point, or when I decide to retire, that this office is ready to go and ready to operate independently and successfully. So here I am.
Thank you so much for making the time, because you have been so busy and you're like providing daily press briefings. So thank you for making the time this morning.
You're welcome. Great to see you, Vicki. Thank you.
Kathy Darling Allen is the Shasta County Clerk and Registrar of Voters and has led elections in the county for nearly 20 years, overseeing more than three dozen elections. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a contentious and divisive recall election that's happening in Shasta County. The recall is a signal to some of the political fault lines forming along or between elected officials and angry constituencies who are finding a voice in ultra-conservative movements. So what does this recall tell us about politics and governing in California? What impact, if any, would this recall have on future elections across the state? Here to help us answer those questions is Dr. Lisa Pruitt, a professor at UC Davis Law School who focuses on how rural communities engage with their local and state governments. Lisa, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Vicki. It's nice to be here.
As someone who writes about and studies rural communities, what stands out to you about this recall election that we were just talking about in Shasta County?
Well, what stands out for me is this divide between what we might think of as two factions on the right or two factions of Republicans. I heard another journalist based in Reading this morning say there are, you know, regular Republicans and regular Democrats. And then she called sort of this militia farther right force the alt-right. So we could go with that terminology. So what we've had emerge in Shasta County is this militia, which we could call, you know, an alt-right. I want to be very careful with my use of language, but I'm trying to come up with language, right, to express this distinction. And they have obviously been very agitated. And so what we've basically seen is a war between, you know, two factions of Republicans or two factions, you know, of the right. And that alt-right faction, that militia aligned faction, has shown itself to be strong, strong enough to remove an official with very standard Republican credentials, a former police chief, someone who has repeatedly in the media called himself a Reagan Republican. So that's interesting. It may be that we're not seeing similar things in the surrounding more rural counties because those boards of supervisors are already farther to the right. What we saw in Shasta County is, again, you had, I guess, five Republicans on the board of supervisors, but they fell at different points along the continuum.
Yeah. I mean, it's important to mention that that's a very important point, that although Shasta County, relatively speaking, across the state is a smaller county, it is really the largest county in the upper northern California. I mean, you have like Lassen, Tehama, Plumas, Sierra. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Right. You know, in Sacramento and certainly points south of here, we tend to think of all of the north state, what I sometimes call or hear called the would-be state of Jefferson as rural. But in fact, as Kathy Allen mentioned just a few minutes ago, there are 200,000 people living in Shasta County. That makes it a metropolitan county by the federal government's definition. And Reading, I believe, has more than 100,000 people and has long been the population behemoth between here and the Oregon state line. Although, of course, Butte County and Chico has grown a lot recently because of the influx of residents after the Paradise Fire. But yeah, these are the population leaders in the North State. And so, what's happening in Shasta County might have an influence on, you know, surrounding counties. You listed some of them, or it might not, because it may be that the boards of supervisors are you know, more uniformly on the same page already within those counties.
What do you think this recall election has gained, or why has it gained so much state and national attention? And what should people from larger urban centers in California, what should they think about and what should they understand about the people in politics of more rural communities and a county that is, by definition, a metropolitan county because of its size?
Well, I think the reason that this has gained so much attention, as you mentioned, even nationally, is because of this association with a militia and the use of the term militia. And, you know, I've read through a lot of the coverage going back a couple of years of, you know, the politics of Shasta County. And this, you know, by one report from, I think, about a year ago, there was a suggestion that this militia had maybe 11 members, but maybe it's grown since then. So, you know, militia is in some ways an ambiguous term. And so we, you know, we don't really know what this this militia is up to. Apparently it's been in Shasta County for a long time. Maybe it's fate waxing and waning. And so forth. But the truth is, we don't know, you know, to use an old expression, whether, you know, there's the old expression, is he all hat and no cattle? So we can hope that the militia is mostly hat and mostly talk and you know, not violent. But of course, we really don't know. And I heard the Reading journalist on another program this morning say that the presence of the militia At the Black Lives Matter protests in Reading in the summer of 2020, was very threatening and very ominous. And, you know, we know from newspaper reports that these militia members are carrying guns, and you know, presumably they're doing so consistent with the laws of the state of California. But this is very this can be very threatening, obviously.
When you last joined us on Insight, and you touched upon this briefly right now in our conversation, but we discussed the city of Oroville branding itself a constitutional republic. Do you view Oroville's resolution and this recall election in Shasta County as an evolution of the State of Jefferson movement, which was created in that area, you know, back, what, in 1940, 1941?
Yes, definitely. Because the same sort of themes are present, right? That the folks in the North State, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but many folks in the North State, particularly the inland parts of the North State away from the coast, don't feel that Sacramento, that the state of California, that state lawmakers really represent their interests. They don't believe that, you know, in a very urban state like California, that, you know, rural livelihoods and rural priorities and, you know, with a focus on freedom and a desire not to be regulated and not to pay heavy gas taxes. And, you know, the list goes on and on. They just don't feel understood and represented. And so we're seeing the same thing now in the context of these pandemic regulations, right? So the state regulations around mask wearing and vaccines, and closure of businesses early in the days of the pandemic. You know, a lot of rural folks like those we're seeing, you know, speak out in Shasta County, just don't feel like this is a good fit for them. It runs afoul of their sense of, you know, self-sufficiency, and they'll make their own decisions. And obviously there's a lot of freedom-loving rhetoric, you know, that we're hearing as part of this.
In the last minute that we have, yeah, I just want to end with, I'm curious, do you think that this is an isolated political victory, or is this essentially, or could be, a possible roadmap for other groups to gain footholds and positions of power in future California elections beyond Shasta County and beyond Northern California?
Well, I suppose it's possible. I mean, I don't know the extent to which militias exist, but if we take the in California, but if we take the militia out of it and we just think about factions that of Republicans or factions that are, you know, further right within the Republican Party, then certainly, right? You know, we could see this sort of behavior. I mean, certainly we see enormous agitation, right, in all over the state. I mean, we see the sheriff of Los Angeles County saying he's not going to enforce mask mandates. This is not just a rural phenomenon. And I think a lot of the activity and the agitation that we see is greatest in places like Shasta County and maybe El Dorado County, Placer County, even these counties around Sacramento, where you have this rural-urban, this clash, right? Because it is a city and you do have more formally educated people. And if we think about how, you know, Sacramento is sprawling out into El Dorado County, and every time I'm in El Dorado County, you know, I see election signs that say, you know, keep El Dorado County rural. So we have these clashes in our own region, and sometimes those play out in terms of, you know, the farther right or the alt-right politics versus sort of, you know, what we could think of as classic California Republicans.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Pruitt. It certainly is an exciting time for you and all your research.
Yes, people are much more interested in rural people and places than they were a decade ago. That's true.
Dr. Lisa Pruitt is a professor at UC Davis Law School, providing more context into the recall election of the Shasta County Board of Supervisors. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's a word being used to describe what may become the next phase of COVID-19. the pandemic becoming endemic, essentially a disease that will likely always be with us, but with a more predictable rate of spread like the flu, malaria, and HIV. Some medical experts believe COVID should already be considered endemic. But what does a world where COVID is endemic actually mean? If the virus is here to stay, what happens next? Do the best and brightest scientists studying the virus agree on what endemicity looks like? And will that word eventually roll off our tongues? These were the questions that The Atlantic magazine sought answers to. In their reporting, they discovered how ambiguous and uncertain the vision of a post-pandemic world really is, and even how using the term endemic to describe it is problematic. Joining us now from The Atlantic is assistant editor Jacob Stern and staff writer Catherine Wu to discuss what they learned and shared in their article titled Endemicity is Meaningless. Jacob and Catherine, welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, let's first off start with the title. Can you briefly tell us what inspired you both to pursue this article and how you reached this conclusion by the end of it?
I'm happy to start here. I think I personally noticed, here I'll only speak for myself, not for Jacob, but I noticed this word just appearing everywhere. You know, it seemed like with the sort of decline of this idea of, oh, the pandemic is going to end in herd immunity, there's this rise of the word endemicity. You know, the virus is going to be here. You laid it out nicely, Vicky, just now, this idea that this is what lies beyond the end of the pandemic. And it seemed like such a neat little term. I was just curious what that could possibly mean, because there are so many shapes that endemicity can take. And when I started reporting, I think alongside Jacob, we just figured out that it was even more complicated than we had imagined to begin with.
Yeah, I'd add that, like Katie, I'd heard this word starting to crop up a lot. What I'd sort of started thinking about as I set out to report this piece was, what are some of the kind of little inconveniences that will come with this new phase? And then only once I started really getting into the reporting did I start to understand that this wasn't just a matter of what will the little inconveniences be, but that this term that we've been using so much doesn't really have all that much behind it at all.
Well, Jacob, I mean, the article states that endemicity has so many definitions that it means almost nothing at all. The both of you talked to so many public health experts and medical experts. Explain what you learned in terms of why defining an endemic world is just so ambiguous.
Sure. So I think the first thing to say is it's helpful to start by just dispelling some of the misconceptions about the word means before even approaching this question of what it does mean, if anything. Two of the common ones, I think, are this idea that in an endemic phase, there's not very much disease. There are very few infections. That is not at all guaranteed. Another misconception, I think, is this idea that an endemic disease is necessarily mild. That is also not the case. In terms of what it does mean, as you suggested, were so many different different points on which the experts we talked to weren't always in agreement. Does an endemic disease have to be highly predictable? How predictable does it have to be? Does it have to be concentrated in a specific place? Some of the experts we talked to said that, you know, for a disease to be endemic, it has to be endemic to someone somewhere. Others were a lot less concerned by that. Some of them referred to this kind of more formal definition where an endemic disease is one in which transmission is controlled by what's called the resupply of susceptibles, which just means as more people are gaining immunity by getting infected, more people are losing immunity, or more vulnerable people are coming into the population, whether that's by being born or because their immunity is waning. And then others said that actually maybe that formal definition doesn't even hold up, and it's just any kind of sustained transmission counts as endemicity. So there's this whole mess of differing opinions on what the term actually means. And when you try to put all together, I think we both sort of found that you come up empty-handed.
Yeah, especially because your article really highlights that, you know, endemic diseases, or calling something endemic, doesn't really say anything about the severity of this disease. I mean, it could be innocuous or it could be severe. I mean, it could be, you know, herpes, which is like a cold sore, or the flu. It could be malaria or HIV. And that leads me to, you know, I think this hope that we all have that, you know, you associate with the word endemic, you know, the word at the beginning or the first three letters end, as in like a final chapter of the pandemic, or returning to life as it was back in 2019 or the early months of 2020. But, you know, Catherine, you argue that the arrival of this is really just the beginning. I mean, the beginning of what?
I think that's the huge question here, right? I think, you know, all of these possible iterations and features that Jacob just laid out so nicely, you know, this really creates an enormous period of uncertainty, which I think we've all grown incredibly familiar with over the past 2 years. I think there's this kind of idea that if we can contain endemicity to just this one word, you know, oh, thank God, the pandemic is going to be over. Look how much better and how much simpler it's going to be. But considering that endemic doesn't really mean all that much, and we can debate all day what we're trying to get this word to mean, is it really useful to talk about endemicity? You know, I think this idea that we're going to reach endemicity, or this virus is going to reach endemicity, it oversimplifies just how difficult things are going to be. And it sort of strips away our ability to say, you know what, it's actually us that controls the future, regardless of what we're calling it, regardless of whether we say, oh, endemicity is going to happen on, you know, June 16th, 2024. Like, no one can say that. It is not some light switch we can flip. But, you know, there is room here to sort of reframe the conversation. And instead of saying, oh, you know, endemicity, it is on its way any second now, it's more about how do we sort of control this virus? How do we reshape our relationship here? And, you know, that's what's ahead. That's what will bring the pandemic to an end. That's what will dictate what things look like beyond this. I can't tell you what that's going to be, because it depends so much on what we decide to do in the interim.
And the both of you really capture, you know, just the contrasting and the spectrum of contrasting views of what endemicity actually is when talking to epidemiologists and experts. You know, in one paragraph, none could potentially agree on what it actually means. But what did they all agree on? Were there any common threads through your reporting?
I might have to pass this one off to Katie. I'm not sure I can think of anything that every single person we talked to agreed on.
Yeah, honestly, it's a pretty difficult question to answer. And I think the fact that we're both waffling a little bit here shows how meaningless the term has been. I think the closest, maybe the closest we could come to consensus is just something a little bit more stable than now, but that's not a terribly high bar to clear. I think, you know, the diseases you listed at the beginning of this segment, I think just illustrate just how insane this range is. And certainly not even everyone agrees on what diseases you can call endemic. Not everyone considers flu endemic. Not everyone considers tuberculosis endemic. Not everyone considers HIV endemic. It sort of depends on your tolerance for something. And it's not like saying, oh, the pandemic is gone. That doesn't guarantee endemicity. I think part of it is just almost like a political or social tolerance for how much disease we consider to be a sort of tolerable background rate. But that's more about what we think as a society rather than, oh, the virus has suddenly reached this magic objective level. That's endemicity.
Right. As long as we kind of view or feel this crisis as being tolerable or constant or acceptable, I mean, which is just subjective, that's not a very meaningful definition of what endemic is in terms of public health across the country. I guess when, and it's so interesting that they don't even agree on like whether the flu is endemic. Jacob, what surprised you most in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, this point about the flu might have been it. The flu is, I mean, I think to so many of us, along with the common cold, sort of this paragon of what an endemic disease is. It's this fixture of our lives. And then we started talking to all these people and digging in and found that actually even this seeming foothold was not at all solid. And a third of the people we talked to thought the flu was endemic, a third of them thought it wasn't, and a third of them said something along the lines of maybe it is or I don't know. So that was really surprising to hear. There were a number of kind of issues at play there, some of which we've already mentioned with respect to other endemic diseases. There is this question of seasonality. The flu is obviously a seasonal virus, but it's not wholly predictable. There are large variations year to year in terms of how many people it's infecting, how many people it's killing. At what point are those variations so large that we can't even call it endemic anymore because there's not that element of predictability that some people think we need? And then, of course, you have years where it even goes fully pandemic, whether that's 1968 or more recently, 2009. We have this issue again of geography, where does a disease need to be endemic to a particular population in a particular place? The flu is not that. So just hearing all of these different questions about the flu and its status, I think was really surprising to us.
I'm just curious, the both of you are living through this pandemic, just like every single one of us. When you were done with your reporting, how did you feel, Catherine?
That's a great question. I mean, I will admit that I think the past 2 years have collectively numbed me a little bit. So maybe I would have felt a little more shocked if I had been reporting this story earlier. But honestly, my largest takeaway here is that I don't particularly want to use the word endemic anymore to describe what comes next. You know, certainly I think it is worthwhile and in fact necessary to discuss what comes after the pandemic, how we're going to keep this virus under control. But you know, it's not about picking the right word or the right, you know, buzzy phrase. It really is about, I think, thinking about what is feasible, what is actionable, and what people are going to be willing to tolerate. You know, we're not even at the end of the pandemic, technically, and people are already talking about it. It's a very simple way to frame things, but it sort of just strips away our agency, I think. And I guess how I feel is maybe motivated to convince people to put themselves, you know, as hosts of this virus back into the equation.
Yeah. Jacob, how did you feel?
Yeah, no, I think that last point is really the crucial one. On one level, this is admittedly a really depressing piece in that it sort of dispenses with the false certainty behind this term endemicity and blows it open so that there are now all of these many possible futures ahead of us, some of which are really unpleasant and some of which are less unpleasant. But I think the more positive way of thinking about it and where the piece really ends is with this idea that, yes, there's this uncertainty, but with that comes agency and the idea that we actually have a huge amount that we can do to determine which one of those possible futures we find ourselves in.
Jacob and Catherine, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for
Thanks so much for having us.
Jacob Stern is an assistant editor of The Atlantic, joined by staff writer Catherine Wu, sharing with us their reporting and analysis on their article, Endemicity is Meaningless. On that note, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As the weather warms up, a beloved insect that rivals a ladybug graces us with a California return. Butterflies, and one of the most adored, the monarch butterfly. However, over the years, we've seen sharp declines, followed by slight increases in monarch populations. And scientists are still working to figure out what is causing these fluctuations. One key to keep track is by relying on butterfly counters. Yes, people who count butterflies and provide a tally across California. Manola Sakaida is CAP Radio's environment reporter and recently took a trip to the Monarch Butterfly Sanctuary in Pacific Grove near Monterey to learn more about how volunteers count these beautiful and essential pollinators and what it means to researchers. Manola joins us now with her reporting. Welcome back to Insight, Manola.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Manola, you're new to the area. You came here from Seattle. What was it like to travel to the coast of Pacific Grove and report on this story?
Right. So for some context, Pacific Grove is this small town by Monterey that's been this big destination place for people who want to see monarch butterflies in the winter for a really long time. And typically what happens is that thousands of monarchs will settle in Pacific Grove anywhere between October to, you know, as late as mid-February to wait out the colder months before continuing their migration. And that part of the migration is called overwintering. So yeah, it was my first time in the area, and it was also my first time getting to see monarch butterflies up close. And it was just, you know, really amazing to see these huge clusters of butterflies up close, just in numbers I've never seen before. So it was a really amazing experience, and one that I hope we can still have more opportunities for in the future.
You spoke with three butterfly counters one morning. What does a butterfly counter do? And it's really important, right, that they do their work as the sun is rising?
Yeah, exactly. Basically, a butterfly counter is a person that's been trained to tally monarch butterflies in a specific area and keep track of them. And it's part of this larger statewide effort to understand where monarchs are coming together, you know, how many of them are there in certain places each year. And all of this is with the intention of helping conserve their numbers in the future. So yeah, I got to spend some time with butterfly counters in Pacific Grove for this year's count. And it was a big deal, since last year there were no butterflies in Pacific Grove to count at all. And right, it has to start at sunrise because it's really fast work. Butterflies can't fly when it's cold outside, but once the temperature passes 55 degrees, they start to fly off in these big bursts. So basically the counters have to finish counting the butterflies before it gets too warm. And then, you know, they're all over the place. It's impossible to count them. So yeah, they start at sunrise and it takes a while. And when I was there, it took about 2 hours.
And it's all volunteer run, or the volunteers are counting. How did they become involved?
Yeah, the volunteers don't necessarily have a research background or a science background before becoming counters, which I thought was really interesting. The volunteers I met were people who lived in the area and were passionate about butterflies for all kinds of reasons. And also, like one counter told me, just, you know, really believe in community science efforts like this one. So yeah, that's how they kind of became interested. And then what happens next is that you can get a training through the Xerces Society, which is, the full name is the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And they have led a lot of these documentation efforts of monarchs and have been tracking them for a while, and have this open training for anyone to learn how to do that.
So what is the training like to count butterflies?
It starts with this counting process, this really special method for counting butterflies. It's like an estimation. One of the counters I spoke to actually said it was kind of like counting jelly beans, but if the jelly beans are moving around. So it's like an estimation where you look at these big clusters of butterflies and then use this method of counting butterflies that, you know, obviously you can't count one by one. And it also helps you to do it quickly before they start flying around.
You mentioned that last year there weren't butterflies to count, which is just really scary given that, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions have been known to fly through our area. What is going on with the monarch butterfly population in California?
Mm-hmm. It's this big, you know, decades long issue that's been going on. But basically in the 80s, there used to be millions of monarchs that would migrate through California every year. But yeah, in recent years, that has really changed. Those numbers have really dwindled. And in 2020, last year, there were less than, or I guess a couple of years ago now, there were less than 2,000.
It all feels the same.
California. Yeah. But anyways.
You said less than 2,000, correct? I'm sorry, I interrupted
2,000.
You.
Yeah. No, exactly. But this year there was, you know, a really huge boom that kind of surprised everybody. And the official count that was tallied in November counted about 247,000. So in this year's migration, so that was, you know, a really big boost from what we've been seeing in recent years.
Oh yeah. From, you know, less than 2000 in 2020 to now more than, or nearly 250,000. I mean, that's great. But overall the number is declining. So why is that number declining in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically what I've been told is that there's not really a single reason that this is happening, but researchers have some guesses. And one guess that I heard over and over again was its connection to climate change. So, you know, like I mentioned earlier, monarchs are so sensitive to temperature and weather, And if temperatures rise earlier than usual, there's concern that it could mess with their migration cycle. I also talked to Liza Murphy, who's the director of education and outreach at the Pacific Grove Museum of Natural History, about this.
They've been adapted over thousands and thousands of years to a certain rhythm of nature. And now the pace of the change of nature is so much faster. They can't possibly adapt to spring arriving a month early or rain arriving 2 months late.
Yeah. And obviously there are going to be consequences to that as well for years. Mm-hmm. What should we make of this sudden boom in the population?
Yeah, so I also talked to Serena Jepson about this big boom, and she's the director of the Xerces Society, which I mentioned earlier, specifically the Endangered Species Program with them. And she told me that likely the boom was the result of just having, you know, the right conditions during breeding season last year, you know, maybe the right temperature, a good amount of milkweed, which is what monarch larvae eat. And it's not really certain if that is going to happen reliably again. So even though this year is a good thing, it doesn't mean that the future of monarchs is completely certain.
It's a very hopeful sign. And it, to me, it says we have a little bit more time to work on recovering the monarch population. They have not been wiped out as we had feared last year.
Yeah, and we're learning, you know, how sensitive monarch butterflies are to weather patterns. I mean, the individual before was saying, you know, if they can't adapt to spring, they arrive a month early, or rain arriving 2 months late. What happens if they leave too early? How can that affect the population?
Yeah, so some researchers worry that temperatures warming earlier in the year might be a signal for monarchs to also leave their overwintering spots early. So, you know, like leaving Pacific Grove too early. And anecdotally, the butterfly counters I met told me that they'd seen butterflies leaving earlier than usual, you know, as early as mid-January, when usually they leave a month later than that. And the danger with that is that they could leave before their food source is ready, you know, milkweed, and that can have all these rippling effects. So, you know, if food isn't available when monarchs breed and they have babies, you know, that can really cut back on the number of monarchs we'll see in coming years, because, you know, what happens this year really directly translates to the monarchs we'll see next year. So it's important to keep milkweed safe, and also to keep track of, you know, if monarchs are leaving too early, where they're going, and making sure that the habitats that they end up in are, you know, healthy ones.
You were learning about volunteers in Pacific Grove, but monarch butterflies are throughout the state and in our area. What can we do to help preserve this population or the species?
That was one of the, you know, really cool parts of this, is that, you know, again and again, I kept hearing that anyone can be part of this. So, you know, while we don't understand why this decline is happening, a lot of the work that's going on right now and tracking them can really help us understand and hopefully help them in the future. So yeah, basically, again, it helps researchers just understand monarchs better, and, you know, following that, keep their habitat safer, and just, again, understand maybe a little bit more about why what's going on is going on. So again, this isn't something that you need to be a trained professional to do. Anyone can contribute. You know, you can go through that Xerces training, but even, you know, easier than that, you can document sightings of monarchs or milkweed and submit that online. The map online is called the Western Monarch Milkweed Mapper. And right, yeah, all of that contributes to our understanding of monarchs as a whole.
Thank you so much, Manola, for taking the trip and sharing your reporting with us.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Vicki.
Manola Cicada is CAP Radio's environment reporter. You can find a link to Manola's story and a video tour of the Monarch Grove Butterfly Sanctuary by CAP Radio's Andrew Nixon on our website, capradio.org. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.